I'd like to thank the organizer very much for inviting me to speak at this very interesting meeting. Let me start by trying to say a few things about what we expect to learn from simulations. Of course, one of the things we look for in simulations is that we hope to get an unbiased view of what the physics of models are. And two traditional aspects that we look for is we look for tests of analytic theories, and we hope to generate curves to compare with experiments. One of the things that we've learned over the years is that they can also provide us with vital insight into the nature of correlations, which we might not have been smart enough to think of before we saw the simulations. And so, for instance, details about the correlations involved when holes bind in pairs, if they do, what's that like, why do stripes form? These are things that the simulations can provide insight about. One of the other aspects, though, is that we only learn about the particular models that we study. And so then a question is, well, but what have we really learned? How generic are these models? And so let me put up sort of a, this is sort of a straw man. This is sort of an idea that one might have had in the early days of IPC about how these models have solutions. I won't accuse anybody of having this particular idea, but what we have over here is a space of what I'll call reasonable models. And so I'm going to consider TJ and Hubbard, Reband Hubbard, all those to be reasonable models, and also reasonable if we vary the parameters somewhat, including adding small parameters like the next nearest neighbor hopping T prime. So we have this space of reasonable models, and then we have some sort of ideal calculation, some simulation. And then we come over here to the solutions, and we say, what do we get? Now, if we were very lucky, maybe all of these models would flow into some broad space that's a generic D-wave superconductor. And so it wouldn't matter what model we started with, all the model differences would be irrelevant. And perhaps there are some simple analytically solvable points over here that we can use to sort of form our BCS theory for the Coupe race. Okay, now let me put up what I think is more realistic. Now, the emphasis is on more realistic, but it's mostly guesses based on what we're seeing in the simulations. And so I'll present evidence in support of these ideas, but this is still just sort of a guess. So we start over here with our reasonable models, and instead of things flowing down with most model differences being irrelevant, instead we have something that expands out into giving us a lot of different possible phases. So for instance, we may have something with static stripes, we may have a uniform D-wave superconductor. We may have things with fluctuating stripes and superconductivity. We may have different types of stripes. We may have something with neither stripes or superconductivity. Then there are also things that could happen which we apparently don't see. And so I've drawn over here some things that appear not to occur in these models, although we can't really say for sure because we can't really explore all the states of reasonable models. But I'll show you some results that tend to suggest that these are outside the range of reasonable solutions, such as in-phase stripes, phase separation, or S-wave superconductivity. Now, if this sort of view is correct, then we have to ask different questions than we're used to. We'd like to know what ranges of behavior are possible with realistic models, rather than just focusing on a particular model. What phases are not seen, and what if we sit over here, say in this static stripe phase, what are the specific properties of those phases? Okay, so those are the sort of questions that I'm going to try to address in the talk. I'm going to show you some details of the numerical calculations. I think one of the key issues is, since we're getting these results, you have to know whether you want to believe them or not. So I'm going to show you some details of the calculations, including a little movie that shows the calculation evolve, so you can do a better job of judging for yourself if you think what you think about the conclusions. So the simulations are done with DMRG. This is a numerical renormalization group method based on Wilson's original approach to the Kondo impurity problem. It's an adaptation of that method to lattice systems. Now, there are a couple of key points which I want to emphasize about this method. First of all, it's not an RG that adds states in one direction. It actually goes in both directions. It reverses back and forth. And so one path back and forth in adding these degrees of freedom is called a sweep. And the second thing is that in two dimensions, we have to map the system essentially onto a one-dimensional system with this green path here. And so the difficulty is associated with trying to make this system wider and wider. So the calculation can be done accurately for quite long systems, but as soon as you make the width very wide, it gets quite difficult. The other thing is that since we're sort of tracing this unphysical path to the system, it can take quite a few sweeps to converge to the best approximation to the ground state. And so you'll see that in some of the results I'm showing. Okay, so now let me show you an example calculation. And this is a very simple calculation. It's a 12 by 6 system with two holes. And now to show you the convergence issues with the simulation, I'm going to start this this calculation in a bad starting position. So I'm starting the calculation with the two holes localized at opposite ends of the system. Now this system has cylindrical boundary conditions. So in the vertical direction, it's periodic. It's open on the two ends. So these two holes are quite far apart. And then I start this calculation, and it undergoes sweeps, and we see what happens to the state of the system as the calculation progresses. So the nature of the calculation is that at any point, we can look at the properties of the state that we have. So at the end of sweep one, we have the two holes localized very near where I put them in. They have a certain energy we can monitor. There's also an internal energy of the error of the calculation, this discarded weight epsilon, which we can monitor. And then we proceed in the calculation. The parameter that controls the accuracy, besides just how many sweeps we've done, is this parameter M, which is how many states we're keeping in the calculation. So we try to increase that as much as we can until we run out of computer power. Now, what you see here is that even after, what's striking to me about this is that even after sweep six, the holes have not delocalized terribly much. And this is showing real physics. This is showing how difficult it is for holes to move in an antiferromagnetic background. As we continue the calculation, the holes delocalize more and more. The energy steadily drops. Our estimate of the internal error steadily drops.
You
have
some
fields
on the boundaries,
as well as the antiferromagnetic. There's no fields put on or anything. I'll show you what the spins are doing in a moment. Okay, and here's the rest of the calculation. The holes gradually spread out more and more. Eventually, the two holes see each other, which is around here. This is where they first see each other. All of a sudden, this measure of the internal error goes up. And there's a very rapid change in one sweep where the holes see each other and they bind together. And so at the end of the calculation, we have the two holes essentially bound together rather weakly in this this state here. Also, somewhat delocalized. The truncation error has gone back down. And that's essentially the final result of the calculation. Now, what are the spins doing? The spins form a sort of Mayel state essentially immediately. And so I didn't show the spins at the same time as the rest, just to keep it simple at the beginning. But As the calculation progresses, what you see is that the spin moments are disappearing. Now, this is not showing that it's not an anti-ferromagnet anymore. What it's showing is that there's a particular preferred direction for the spins when you don't keep many states. The basis that we use is in the z direction. And so it's very easy to make a low-energy state with nail order in the z direction, but it's difficult to build in the rotational averaging of the spins that characterize the actual singlet nature of the exact solution. So building in the singlet nature of the exact solution is something that's quite difficult, and you see that it happens rather slowly. The moments gradually decrease as we progress through the simulation. Basically, you can think of it as an averaging over all the directions for the antiferromagnetism in the calculation. Now, often, I think of this as just an example of broken symmetry, which is induced by the numerical calculation. In a larger system, this tendency is even stronger, so that often we can't get down to a regime where the spin moments have all disappeared. Now, the behavior of the energy with the truncation error tells us a lot about what's going on in the calculation. So this is the energy versus this epsilon parameter. This is the simulation that I just showed, sort of has this irregular behavior. But this is behavior where I started the holes far apart, where they'd rather be together. If I do a similar calculation, but all I do is I just put the holes together at the first sweep, then what you get after a sort of a warm-up period is an extremely linear behavior of the energy with this discarded weight. And so this allows us, this is a generic behavior, there are simple arguments in support of this. This allows us to extrapolate past where we could actually go with the simulation to get energies extrapolated to peaking an infinite number of states. Okay, now, so what that calculation has shown, I think, is that we can also get the pair binding energy from this calculation. It's a finite pair binding energy. Okay, now what I think that's shown is that in that particular system, we have a binding of pairs. Okay, so then the next question is, well, what about more generally, do two holes bind in two dimensions? And unfortunately, for this pure PJ model, the finite size extrapolations are rather unclear. As we make the system wider, we get irregular behavior, so it's not completely clear. But if we take this attitude that there's nothing so special about the TJ model, that suppose we vary some parameters, we can at least find some idea about universality in the behavior. And in fact, if you make the T prime, this is the hopping at distance root 2, if you make the T prime positive, what you find is that the pairing is actually much stronger. And so it seems very likely, although we haven't yet done the finite size study, it seems very likely that there's pair binding in the 2D system for positive T prime. On the other hand, for negative T prime, we find no binding even on these small clusters. And so it seems very unlikely that there's pair binding in 2D. So it seems like the question of whether two holes bind at zero doping is not a universal property. We can vary this just reasonable parameter T prime and get either answer. Okay, now, besides this, the other important question is, if they do pair, why do they bind in pairs? Why do the holes bind? And I think, given that we can see them bind and dissect the nature of the state that we get, it's not surprising that we can understand a lot about this. And I think that, at least in my view, the qualitative nature of the strong coupling correlations involved in pair binding are fairly well understood. I won't go into it, but there are some buzzwords like dynamic frustration, there are singlet bonds across the mobile holes, and you can read about this. You can also address the question of why it's a D-wave pair. And one interesting way of seeing that is just to take a 2x2 system and do an exact diagonalization by hand, and you can see exactly why why we get a D-wave pair. You also see why the sine of T-prime works as it does. And then what you get from the simulations is that you see from the simulations that the behavior on the 2x2 plaquette actually is a reasonable description of the pairs in larger systems. Okay, and then one can also describe the attraction, the attractive interaction from a weak coupling point of view. It's at least in terms of the interaction between two holes, it's probably connected between weak and strong coupling. Okay, now let's go to more holes, and a step at a time, we'll just put in almost the same system, put in four holes. Now, in this case, you find that there's two nearly degenerate states, and the DMRG calculation is not easily able to start in one state and get to the other state. So it's difficult to directly start at an arbitrary point and get to the ground state. So one of these two states is if we just put in the two pairs at opposite ends of the system, they essentially stay there, they repel each other and they repel from the ends of the system, and so you have these two pairs just like the pair in the previous calculation. We can take this calculation and extrapolate the energy and get an accurate value of the energy. Now, if you start the calculation with the four holes in the vicinity of each other, just together, they immediately form this state that looks very much like a strike. And I've color-coded the arrows so that you can see the A phase and the B phase of the antiferromagnetism. There's a pi phase shift across this. We can see which one is favored in this particular system by doing the energy extrapolation here. And what you find is that the strike is favored. You get a pair binding energy of this. It's not, it's close to being degenerate, so we don't have a completely clear answer that this is all favored, always favored from this calculation. Okay, we can vary J a little bit and find that it still continues to favor this. So you might say, well, you know, how do you know which this is not clear enough to say which one is favored? But let me point out something, which is that this doping in this system here is about 5% doping. And this top solution, if you increase the doping, would be less stable, because as you add more pairs in, here then you would have a repulsion between these pairs, which you can see because they spread out. And so this one, the energy would go up more as you added, as you push the holes together compared to this. So we expect this to be much more favored at higher doping. Now, in fact, when we do calculations at higher doping, this near degeneracy actually we never see again. This is sort of the lowest, this is the highest doping where we see this possibility of the pairs still existing. Okay, now what happens when we go to higher doping? And let me show you a movie. Now there are some questions to be addressed, such as what about phase separation? If so far I put four holes together and they bind together, even if it's a strike, you could say, well, that's just one manifestation of phase separation. Okay, so in order to tell the difference between phase separation and strike formation, what you really need is that you need to have enough holes to have two strikes. Then you can say, well, would all those holes go into one blob or would they go into two strikes? Okay, so let me show you a movie of the calculation with eight holes in a 12x8 system. And this one, it doesn't have any metastable states. I'm going to start it in a state that favors the phase separation. And what you're going to see is that phase separated state is unstable and it's going to separate into two strikes. Okay, so what you're actually seeing is the detailed sweeping of the DMRG calculation. All the holes went in at the very beginning. The antiferromagnetic order that you see arose completely spontaneously. There's no fields put on. This again has cylindrical boundary conditions. And we can just sort of watch it evolve. And the initial sweeps, since they don't matter very much, I keep relatively few states. In the end, we'll go up to 2,200 states. You can see the energy steadily decrease as the system evolves. Now, take note of the color of the spins in the middle here. They're already flipping green in the middle of this, and that's actually going to drive the formation of, or partially drive the formation of the stripes. So first they sort of immediately spread out into sort of a rather broad thing, and then you see more and more of the antiphase spins coming in the middle, and then now you're seeing the density of holes in the middle actually starting to drop. Each sweep, they drop a little bit more. They continue to drop. I wish I could speed up the display a little bit, but my laptop's not fast enough.
Get a new chip.
Yeah.
Question. Do you preserve SP2 symmetry in the manner you truncate the Hilbert space?
No. I could preserve, it's a lot of work, but in principle I could preserve the SU symmetry. And then these magnetic moments would always be exactly zero. I could just work in a single state.
What does the green color mean? What does the green color mean?
So there's antiferromagnetism where on the odd sites you have up, or on the odd sites you have down. Let's call that the A and the B phase. I've color-coded that, it's completely automatic. If an up over here, is, this would be, say, an odd site, and this would be an even site.
Question?
Oh, one more. Let me point out another thing at this point. See that the stripes at this point are completely bond-centered. Now, they're going to end up site-centered. That's strongly influenced by the boundary conditions. The stripes repel each other until they're sort of equally far away from each other and from the open ends of the system. But notice that it goes right through bond-centeredness because the energy difference between bond-centeredness and site-centeredness is really very tiny. You can sort of see that from the simulation.
A question?
Yeah.
You commented earlier on the relevance or irrelevance of a T prime. Is that with T prime equals zero?
This is with T prime equals zero. I'll say something about that the next slide. Okay, so the point of this is that you see that the stripes are forming completely spontaneously. Now, we have difficulty putting in fully periodic boundary conditions. It makes the calculation much less accurate. But the point of this calculation is that the holes really don't see the ends of the system. The spins see the end of the system, but you know, you can see there's not much difference in the spins between right at the end of the system and further in. So the holes are developing the stripe really before they get to the end of the system. So that's one argument in favor that this is not somehow induced by open boundary conditions. Also, the modulation in the density is so large, hard to picture this as some sort of Fidel oscillation induced by the fields. Unfortunately, that's all the time I have for movies, I think, but... Okay, now let me address the question, the broader question of how universal these stripes are. And again, this T prime parameter seems to be particularly effective at moving you through model space to give you different outcomes. So this is a way of estimating the effect of T prime on stripe stability. So the way this works is that we vary T prime and we look at the energy per hole in various configurations. This has the antiferromagnetic background energy subtracted out for each system. So even though they're different systems, we can compare the energy per hole and essentially see which place the holes are most happy. So whichever has the lowest energy is the thing that we expect to be the state, barring finite size effects. And so the triangles are a stripe, and that goes here. Then we have one hole, which is down here, and then two holes. Now, over to the left here, T prime negative, what you see is a degeneracy between the one hole and the two hole. Now, that's just showing that when you put the two holes in, they fly apart, and so they have the same energy as a one hole state. So this is actually, this degeneracy is actually showing us that the pairs are unstable, which I sort of referred to before. So both of this is below the stripe. So at small t prime, we see that we don't expect any stripes. At larger t prime, we see that the pairs are strongly favored. The stripe is above it, the one hole is above it. And so here we expect somehow to just see pairs. And the region of stability of the stripes seems to be fairly narrow. It includes the point t prime equals zero, but it's a sort of window of t prime around zero. Okay, let me now go on to pairing correlations. And let me first address the question of pairing correlations within a single stripe. Now, pairing correlations are some of our most difficult calculations to do. In a DMRT calculation, when you're having trouble with convergence, what you do is you make the system narrower. It's another way of controlling the calculation. So this calculation that I'm doing is on a 16 by 4. The width is only 4, but that's big enough to hold a bond-centered stripe. And the boundary conditions are prepared to favor this stripe, and so we get a nice stripe. And then now, what I'm looking at here is I've got an operator which creates a singlet pair of holes on a link, and then I look at this delta-delta dagger correlations, and I can orient the links in these two different ways. I can make the links parallel, so this would be a DYY correlation, or I can rotate one of them by 90 degrees and get a DXY. And this is a way of sort of testing directly whether you have D wave or S wave. And what you see up here is that the two different orientations have an opposite sign that indicates DX squared minus Y squared correlation. And so that's you can see that, but what you also see is that the magnitude of these correlations are sort of quite weak. Now, it's a little bit, we don't have the power to find out whether this is exponential or power law, but you can see that it's just by the magnitude here that this is sort of rather weak. Now, part of that weakness just comes from the fact that when we create one of these pairs on a link, we don't do a very good job of creating that pair. And that may account if we did a perfect job of creating one of these pairs, we might increase this by two orders of magnitude. But it's still getting rather small. Now, let's try to dissect that a little bit further. And by making the small system, we force the stripe, we can force it to be an in-phase stripe as well as the usual anti-phase stripe by simply applying staggered fields on the top and the bottom. And then we can get some idea of what the anti-ferromagnetic background and its orientation is doing to the pairing correlations. So the field that, the orientation that's favored is down here. This is with a pi phase shift across the stripe. We can apply no field to this system, or we can apply the field in the opposite direction so that it's in sort of an in-phase stripe. And what you see is that as we progress towards an in-phase stripe, we see stronger pairing correlations. So this is sort of surprising. One calculation that was done to address this before work on this was by Krotov, Lee, and Blatsky, where they looked at L by two ladders and they found that an opposite conclusion that you expect the pairing to go in the opposite direction to this. Now, Deng Hai Lee gave a talk just last week where they've done some more work and found actually their new conclusions are in agreement with our results here. Okay, let me try to give you a little qualitative argument for this behavior of pairing on in-phase versus anti-phase stripes. And this is not a rigorous argument at all, but it gives you some feeling for why we have this tendency. So it's It's just appealing to the basic nature of superconductivity. Pairing, of course, requires strong local charge fluctuations. Essentially, you have states where each pair is delocalized, so it's simultaneously here and not here. If you line these pairs up into a line with a A-phase antiferromagnetism and a B-phase antiferromagnetism, each of these circles represents a pair, you line them up and then you say you want them to have strong charge fluctuations. Basically, what you're doing is you have to have a good state not only when all the pairs are here, but also when pairs are missing. And the problem is that if you have an A phase and a B phase going across the stripe, as soon as you have the pairs missing, you get this region of frustration between the two, where the two types of antiferromagnetic order are in contact. And so this would tend to suppress the pairing fluctuations, but only if these are two different phases and not if they're the same phase. Okay, so that's a qualitative explanation for what we're seeing. This would suggest that you might expect this wouldn't necessarily interfere with ordinary metallic conduction, but you might expect them not to be such good superconductors. So I don't know when I started exactly, but okay. Well, I'm near the end here. Let me now talk about what happens when you include T prime and you look at the effect on strikes and pairing. Now, I said earlier that when you included a T prime and you changed the sign of T prime, you have this region of stability of stripes near T prime equals zero. For T prime negative, the system tended to break up into isolated holes. For T prime positive, it tended to break up into isolated pairs. And so this is showing the side of T prime which is favorable towards superconductivity. So I'm slowly turning on T prime to see what sorts of states I get. At T prime equals 0.1 in this particular system, I have two stripes, and there's not too much difference in this particular system between what you'd get at T prime equals zero. As I increase T prime further, what you see is that the stripes are getting smeared out. So the way we think of that is that the stripes are getting more weakly bound together. And as you increase it still further, at this point at T prime equals 0.3, you see no sign of stripes anymore. Okay? Now, what's that doing to the pairing correlations in the system? So this is just creating a pair here and destroying it over here as you move the two points in. Now, in this particular system, for small t prime, you get essentially no pairing correlations. This is essentially because these holes are sort of localized. They're tightly bound to their stripes in this particular system. The fact that this goes all the way to essentially to zero is really a finite size effect. But as we increase the T prime, what we see is that we get rather substantial pairing correlations. Again, you have to think of putting in this fact that we're not creating a very good pair, and maybe multiply this by two orders of magnitude, and you see that we're getting a rather good response as soon as we substantially weaken the pairs. And it's just coincidence, but between T prime equals 0.2 and 0.3, we see essentially the same response, but in this last case we have no stripes left. In this case we have some weakly bound stripes. Now, if you were going to say, well, what's our best candidate for what's going on in high temperature superconductivity, at least in the phases that seem to have stripes and superconductivity, you could point to this one. The problem with this is I'm sort of considering all of these small values of T prime to give me a reasonable model. I'm assuming that we don't really know as much as some people might say we know about the models and what the parameters should be. However, if you do ask band structure people and other people about what the sign of T prime is that corresponds to the whole dope superconductors, this is going in the opposite direction. So there's still a lot of uncertainty in resulting from these calculations if you start to really pay attention to the details of the model. If you take the broader view that there's too much uncertainty in the models to worry about that, then we are at least seeing various phases which are seen in the high temperature superconductors. We're seeing static strikes, we're seeing D-wave superconductivity, we're seeing mixtures between them, and we can explore further what the details of these various states are. Okay, so to conclude, the pairing and the strikes arise out of the same intermediate coupling interaction between P and J. In none of these calculations did we include longer range Coulomb interactions. It's just a lot of the features are present in just the TJ model or with the addition of the T prime. So in the pure TJ model, we have the stripes being dominant, but once we include the T prime, we can get the stripes to go away and other things can happen. Another conclusion is that when we look at a stripe, we find that the D-wave pairing is relatively weak. And so based on that, we would say that the pairing and stripes tend to compete, although there are certainly parameters that you can put in that destroy both. And we also have states with strong pairing and weakly bound strikes which lead to positive T prime. Okay, thanks.
Thank you for your presentation. The first question was in the background.
Steve, two questions actually. The first one is, in the very first calculation you showed, the charge distribution along the y direction did not seem to be homogeneous, even though you do have translational invariance.
Right.
Is
right.
that because of the truncation of your set of states, or because you truncated your EMRG steps after a finite number?
Yeah, it's not completely clear. There's probably something interesting going on there. Now, it's likely that if we did kept an infinite number of states, it would become rotation invariant. The only exception to that would be if there was a ground state with a finite momentum going around, and so it could have a degeneracy. It could have, and I think that's unlikely, so it could have a near degeneracy that is tending to form the state. But it also could be that the two holes tend to localized at sort of midway apart along the system, and it looks a little bit like sort of in partial striking behavior, but we don't really understand it.
Someone heard a talk from Zorella a few weeks ago where he claims that he's using projected wave functions, and he claims that with open boundary condition, he gets the same answer as you, but with periodic boundary condition, he stabilizes pairing.
We've compared in detail, and with open boundary conditions, so the key question is, do you have just Friedel-like oscillations induced by the boundaries, which don't indicate much about the structure of what's inside, or are these strikes real features? Now, I think the criticism I have of Sandro's calculations is that I think he still has too much of a dependence on the trial wave function that goes into the calculation. So his trial wave function, they don't have a wide variety that work well. They have one sort of class of trial wave functions that work well, and others just give bad energies, and so they don't use them. And those trial wave functions have a fermion determinant, and they're sort of, they can put in some modulation in the density, but that's my main criticism of his calculations. Now, in terms of the details, there's a couple of things. First of all, he's never able to get quite as low an energy as we get. So when we compare our energies are variational, or they can be extrapolated and not variational. But if we just compare, and his energies also tend not to be variational. When we compare those, there seems to be a little bit of discrepancy, and his energies are higher, and I think that that's because he's not really putting in the strike formation.
I'm sorry.
I have a question. The real material, the T prime is negative.
So near T prime separated in both sides and the new.
Yeah.
And could you give any comment on the real material?
That's puzzling. So I don't really have anything. I don't have any clarification on that. It's possible that there are problems with the TJ model, that if you went to a better model, then the role of these parameters such as T prime would change. And then it could be that we're sort of getting towards the right area with this wrong sign of T prime because our model is too far.
I guess you really gave the answer. The point is that this sensitivity with respect to T prime is a little bit disturbing, but if you were to take like a force beam added to it, a force beam...
Force beam coupling?
Force beam coupling, or the next nearest neighbor coupling that augmented the TJ model, I suspect that the sensitivity to T prime might just disappear, just like what you...
Now, I don't know. I think that what we use, we always try to understand what's going on simple arguments once we get a result. And if you, one thing that's been very successful is these diagonalizations that are small enough to do by hand. And there you really see the role of T prime and it makes sense, although I can't explain it here. So you see that T prime has the effect that you expect. And so it may be reasonably...
No, but if you take next nearest neighbor and diagonalize, it gives you a frustration in the problem.
Yeah.
It might still...
We haven't done enough to explore that. The way that's worked is I've tried some other parameters, for instance, the J prime and the T double primes, and not seen such a dramatic effect as we see with T prime.
If I'm allowed to make a short comment. In fact, we have put in long-range Fourier interaction into this calculation, and then we have found that T prime does not play a role. So it goes along your direction. Yeah. Further question, I think, George?
Is it completely impossible to go back to, shall we say, the charge transfer gap model, the rebound model?
We've done that, we've looked at that in ladders. The three-band model is harder to simulate, so we've been restricted so far to ladders. We got some interesting results, which sort of pointed out to some of the flaws in the TJ model, the TJ model, and the one-band Hubbard model, when you think of them as coming from the three-band model. The TJ model tends to bind pairs nicely, but the pairs have a high effective mass. The Hubbard model doesn't have this problem with the effective mass, but its binding of pairs isn't very strong. And so it's sort of, it would be wonderful if we could do more calculations with the three-band model and some of these issues.
Because the signs of the T prime, they come from the cell perturbation from the three-band model.
Yeah, I don't know anything.
And I'm afraid we have to cut short here, and let's thank you.